Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your thoughtful comments, your interesting questions, and we are back to try and respond to some of the issues you've raised, some of the questions you would like the panel to talk about. And I want to start with a question for Jim. You talked about energy efficiency, and Ted told us that he thinks about this sometimes as a grandfather, and I know you do too, because you told me that 5 or 6 years ago when we first got into this issue together. And I want to press you. Is it the case that you're pushing energy efficiency at Duke because you care about the future and you're a do-gooder, or is there a real business case for it here?
Well, Dan, actually now I have 7 grandchildren, and proving I'm a better coach than player. But importantly, that took you a while, didn't it? You're a little tired this afternoon. But Dan, the important point here is, yes, I'm doing it for my grandchildren because that's the right place for us to be. But yes, I'm doing it to make money. Because I had an opportunity to co-chair the National Action Plan on Energy Efficiency. I looked at every state, every company in the country. I looked at what they were doing on energy efficiency, and not enough. And in fact, the chronic underinvestment says we need to change the model at the state level because what we're doing is not enough. California's doing a great job, but they're still not doing enough. We can do more. And that experience really galvanized my thinking and said we have to change the business model. But it isn't automatic for companies like us to change the business model. We have to go to the regulator. We have to convince the regulator. We have to convince the consumer advocates, the environmentalists, at the end of the day, that this is the right thing to do. And it's okay to make money producing value. And my last point is this. Everybody is really supportive of renewables, but renewables are much above the avoided costs of a coal plant or a nuclear plant or a gas plant. But it has a zero footprint. What we're proposing with Save a Watt is at 90% of the avoided cost, it's cheaper, much cheaper than renewables, much cheaper than a new power plant, coal or nuclear. At the same time, it has a zero emissions footprint. So that is something people should endorse, and that is true value that's created for society. And all we're asking is pay us for creating that kind of value.
Thank you, Jim. Mindy, one of the questions here is about whether the SEC shouldn't help by mandating that companies disclose their climate risk. And I want to add something to that. Wall Street has come to this kind of late, and maybe it's because there was a real chance to show short-term profits by not stepping up to this kind of challenge, not being Jim Rogers. What do you think here? Is it time for the SEC to play a role, and should the Accounting Standards Board as well step up and mandate attention to these kind of looming liabilities as we move towards a carbon-constrained future?
Dan, it is not the whole answer, but by all means, we must be living in Never Never Land if we think these are not financial issues. Everybody in this room has articulated that, is acting on that premise. Carbon risk and the cost of climate is a material risk. The SEC is charged with making sure that companies, publicly traded companies, provide information to investors on risks and opportunities. All the SEC needs to do, and they ought to act, and they haven't acted. They don't need to change regulations. They don't need to pass new laws. They need to affirm for companies listed on the stock exchange and filing so-called 10-Ks that the companies need to disclose their risk and disclose it in a way that's clear and accurate so investors in these companies know how to act. Now, disclosure isn't the full answer, but when we find that when companies analyze their risk and their opportunity, they manage it better. So without question, it's a material risk. It ought to be disclosed. If companies aren't disclosed, the SEC knows what to do. They're an enforcement agency, but they certainly haven't been doing what they need to do. It is time for them to step up to the plate because there is no one left on this planet that thinks the risks from climate are not material. They don't rise to the level of something investors want to know, need to know, and we'll see better investment decisions when we get that information.
Mindy, thank you. Ted, you've stepped up to the plate on this issue, but the media world that you used to be part of really hasn't. What's going on? Why haven't we seen these companies taking this issue seriously and being leaders in tackling it?
That's a pretty generalized statement that the media hasn't, because certain aspects of the media have done a pretty good job. I would say that the big media, the television networks, which I'm most familiar with, and They like stories like, you know, O.J. getting in trouble again, the simple stuff, you know, one-liners. This is a very complicated issue. There have been some wonderful documentaries done. HBO did one. CNN did one. There have been probably 15. Obviously, Al Gore's was terrific. That was not the mainstream media that produced Al's program, but they're capable of doing it. But they've kind of reached the conclusion the mass media is going for the masses for the most part, and the stories are too long and too complicated to get in the between commercials. So that, and it's a real danger to our democratic society when the media is just giving us trivial news so much of the time. And CNN is guilty of it now. I made a big mistake letting it get away, but I didn't intend to. But I made it. I did. Because one, if there was just one company out there that at least tried to do it, but there are none of them. I don't think any of them are really, not of the major companies, are giving us the important news. And they're not giving us the news about the war in Iraq either. We don't watch the newscast, though, for a half an hour and see, they won't even mention how many people were killed yesterday. And they never show you a coffin. The government won't let them film them. You know, it's we're underinformed, and it's very it happened. We're letting it happen at our peril.
So one of the interesting things is the Murdoch family seems to have taken this issue seriously. So we may see a Wall Street Journal with a new spin as the new regime takes over.
When I read that, I sent Rupert a congratulatory letter. I did.
So let's bring them back next year and see how the Wall Street Journal is doing as a test of CGI commitment. Sultan, one of the issues that a number of folks in the audience have put to us as a panel is what the right role of government is. Should the government be out there putting money into this investment in alternative energy and energy efficiency? Is the government the right place to pick winners? Or should the government simply put a price on carbon and step back and let the market drive the investment strategy?
That's a very good question. As a matter of fact, the government's role is a very important role. As a matter of fact, it's essential. Without the government taking a serious step into the sector, this won't actually go very far. The government's approach should be a very comprehensive approach. What I mean by that is that for the government to drive innovation through the S technology curve, starting from early stage investments, funding research projects, into VC, private equity investments, into the large deployment and production of such technologies. Let me give you an example. I said earlier Abu Dhabi is committed, and I have an example to demonstrate. We're investing a lot of resources. We're committing a lot of resources for research projects, for R&D. We're committing a lot of resources to a number of institutes and universities around the world. We've set up a clean tech fund to invest in clean technologies around the world. Most of our investments have been into clean technology companies in California and the U.S. in general. We're also, through partnerships and through joint ventures with international companies, we bring those technologies to Abu Dhabi to demonstrate its applicability in our region. We're very serious about adapting clean technologies. Another demonstration, we are organizing and holding the first World's Future Energy Summit in Abu Dhabi, and it's an open invitation to any company that believes that they have a technology that is ready for commercialization. Come to Abu Dhabi, we'll provide you the whole infrastructure for you. We will help you commercialize your technology out of Abu Dhabi.
Sultan, thank you very much. We have now had a team working over the last few minutes, led by David Sandilow, thinking about the common themes that you all have identified over the course of the last half hour. So I'd like to invite David up to share with us the results of that analysis.
Thank you, Dan. You all have been sending an incredible number of examples of climate change business programs back to the theme team. Let's give them a big hand. They just pulling really scores of examples out, and just among the leaders, leading ones, we had examples of reaching out to suppliers, and people talked about Walmart and the program that was talked about in the opening plenary this morning, to customers, citing what Whole Foods is doing, to employees, citing what Swiss Re is doing, and Roger Ferguson talked about at lunch, to mass audiences, talking about what Oprah is doing. We had focus on coordinated policy advocacy and the importance of that with the U.S. CAP program, talking about disclosure and carbon footprint labeling from Tesco and Walmart, among others. People talked about KKR and TPG's buying of TXU. The bank that Bank of America and other leading banks are offering lower interest loans for green buildings. And we actually got so many mentions of the Chicago climate change that I'm convinced that it's not just Richard Sanders sending back the messages to us at the theme team. So all kinds of mentions of that. So really an incredibly inspiring list of programs. The second question was on inspiring visionary leadership, and by far, overwhelmingly, the most comments were in the area of government setting the rules of the road, with people talking about price signals and putting a price on carbon, something we've heard from the panelists as well. We got suggestions about getting the science out to business leaders and just making sure they know the basic science. A lot of comments, too, about management attention and how senior management needs to make clear that this is a priority down the management chain. And somewhat along the same lines on systematization, working through supply chains. And then one comment, just simply think big, and business needs to think big. Some of my favorite comments, we had a suggestion for CEO Oscars, creating a prize to the CEO who makes the largest reduction in carbon dioxide. Somebody suggested sending all Fortune 500 CEOs to the Arctic. And somebody said simply, make sure more people hear Jim Rogers. So.
So by far the most prevalent comment, the one that more tables have sent us than any other, is put a price on carbon. Jim Rogers, how are we going to do that?
I think we have a couple ways to think about it. One, obviously, is a carbon tax, and the other is cap and trade. My bias is more to cap and trade because it's a joint public-private effort. The government sets the cap, and it turns business loose to find the most cost-effective way to meet the cap. It was a great success with SO2 coming out of the Clean Air Act amendments in 1990 in this country. We can learn from what the Europeans did, and I think that it's a way to go forward. And at the end of the day, we'll have a world market, but it'll start as many regional markets, and then the smart traders will find a way to arb the markets, and at the end of the day, we will have a worldwide price, and we'll get the kind of action that we need to deal with this and solve the problem.
So you've suggested, and I think a lot of people in this room agree, that the U.S. is about ready to step up. And I know there's a lot of question about when and how, but I do think that there seems to be a pretty strong consensus that that's coming. Certainly you see the venture money pouring into this arena as a signal that some smart folks like Vinod Khosla and John Doerr, who've bet right before, see this as a big business opportunity, as Ted, you told us. But isn't the question of whether we can take it global really still up for debate? I mean, I think there's a challenge about whether we get where we need to go with China, India, and the rest of the developing world. Sultan, what is it going to take to get us to have a true global perspective on this?
I seriously think that we need to first look at the regulations that we have. We need to have a legal infrastructure that allows this to happen. For example, without having an incentive program for such technologies to be deployed, Let me give you a very small example. Hydrogen power. The technology is out there, but why don't we see it up and running? Simply, the power produced is a little bit more expensive than the conventional way of producing power, and the problem of dealing with carbon. There is no price for carbon, and nobody is willing to buy the carbon at an unannounced price. We're working right now on a very large-scale hydrogen power plant, but we had to convince the government to put a feed-in tariff law in place for us to be able to bring private investors and international investors that has the technology to come and invest in Abu Dhabi to develop such a technology. The oil and gas companies, they had to receive an order from the government saying that you will have to purchase this amount of carbon at this price in order for us to be able to make this project economically viable. So there has to be an incentive program in place in order for you to accelerate the commercialization of such technologies and in order for you to attract such investments into your own local economy.
So let me turn it to Ted. How are we going to get China and India engaged?
I'm an optimist about China and India. I've been to both countries several times, and I think they're just as smart as we are, to tell you the truth. They need to be maybe smarter. Anyway, we're going to have to take a leadership position. I think the United States, I don't know how we do it with the current administration, but we've only got 18 more months. I hate to see another year and a half lost, but
15.
Well, anyway, it keeps changing every month. Anyway. Anyway, I think if we take a leadership position and negotiate fairly and intelligently, we're going to have to get everybody to go along with it. Either that or it's not. We're not going to be here in 50 years.
Mindy, you want to add a thought?
Well, I do think, and here's a quick little picture, Dan. You were at Davos last year, and there was nothing short of 19 sessions on global warming. And the first day when there was a vote of world business leaders, what's the most compelling and important issue? Amongst unbelievably compelling and important issues, climate was noted as one of the top one or two, and people were giddy with, look how fast we're moving. And day two, the head of the Chinese Business Association and Indian Association came in and said, we're building a new coal-fired power plant a week, not because we're bad people. We've got starving people. We've got an economy to build. Coal is the cheapest way for us to build it, and we are going to honor the needs of our country and our people. So what does that tell us? There's a good story and a bad story. What I think we need to recognize, listening to the folks there, is number one, it is very hard for the United States to ask other countries to act until we act and act vigorously. We need to put in place controls. And then we have standing in a global treaty in our ability. The second way I think we could have an impact, a good impact, the Chinese are thinking about how to bring their carbon footprint down. As Ted said, they're quite smart. They want what's good for their people, but they're also trying to build an economy. If we could jumpstart the technology, whether it's carbon capture and sequestration or massive input into renewables where we're seeing massive uptake, I can assure you the other countries, smart, wanting to act, will take that technology in 10 minutes. But we've got to act here in bringing our carbon footprint down, in sending the right market signals to do so, and putting in place the right incentives to develop the technology that will help us here, and it will work in China, and it will work in India. But we've got a lot of work to do, and I think it's this group that will help make that happen.
Jim, you have a further thought.
I think we have to engage every country in the world in this. And to do that, we also at the same time have to recognize that countries are different. They have different geographies. There are different places in their development. And we need to bake that into any way forward. And that way we have everybody engaged in solving the problem. And over time, I'm with Ted and Mindy. I believe that China will step up and do the right thing, because they have incredible environmental degradation in that country. They're going to address those issues, but America's got to lead. We should lead, but we shouldn't talk about it as America leading, because we are so far behind. What we ought to talk about is standing shoulder to shoulder with those who are now leading, because that's the right point. And then if it turns out that we're leaders, that'll be terrific. And I have every confidence we will once we turn our attention to it. But to say that we're going to be the leaders automatically, to me, is presumptuous on our part. We need to be side by side first and then lead.
And as an ex-negotiator and an environmental professor, I can't help but add a footnote on this, which is that we need to restore the principle that it's the only principle that international environmental cooperation has ever been founded on, of common but differentiated responsibility. Common in that every country has to step up and play a role, differentiated in that the expectation will be different for a China or an India as to how much they bring emissions down off what might have been their baseline case. And, of course, the U.S. and Europe will have to do much more. So I think we've got a vision forward, but it is going to take some real will to drive us in that direction. So I want to move on. We're near the end of our time, and just invite any of our panelists who've got a last thought they want to share before we close this session out.
Hi, Mom.
Thank you, Ted. Mindy, a final thought.
My final thought is I think business is absolutely in the state of play in the United States, leading. Government will get into the play, has an inordinate role, but it will happen if business keeps leading. The innovativeness, the ability to invest in clean technology, the kind of intuition in this room and in the business sector will be a crucial part of pushing government, working with government. So I applaud all the things people are doing in this room.
Sultan, 10 seconds.
We need to be courageous, and we need to aim very high.
So I think that's certainly one of the big themes that came out here today. Big vision. Jim Rogers calls it the cathedral vision. And I think recognizing that there is, of course, a challenge. Every company has issues it's got to address. There's an imperative to take up that challenge, and companies that fail to see this as part of strategy really put themselves in peril. But I think the other story, the big story of the day, is the opportunity. And that so many companies are stepping up to that is very, very exciting. Well, we've covered a lot of ground, and I'm going to bring this to a close, but my last task, and it's a great pleasure to be able to do so, is to introduce the former EPA administrator and chairman and founder of Aqua International and the best boss I ever had when I was at the EPA, Bill Riley.
Follow it across the stage. Okay. Thank you, Dan. This is... Like the rest of this tremendously productive and interesting jump up, a really exciting contribution. And the absolute unique idea of the Clean Global Initiatives and of these meetings all boils down to commitments. That's what are solicited. That's what we hope they will stimulate. One will stimulate another. And the result will be the kind of commitments you heard about earlier today and that the President announced this morning. I have some commitments, therefore, to announce and people to invite up to the stage to for all of us to recognize. And the first is a recognition of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, and I want to invite Van Jones, the president, to come up to the stage. Van, this is a commitment to create green-collar jobs that will lift 250,000 Americans out of poverty. It's valued at $12 million. Through the groundbreaking Green for All initiative, the Ella Barker Center for Human Rights is committing to help lead 250,000 Americans out of poverty and into green-collar jobs. With the continued growth in the building, solar, urban forestry, and biofuels sectors, a highly trained green-collar workforce is needed to meet rising demand. Green for All will advocate for a national commitment to greater job training, employment, and entrepreneurial opportunities, especially for people from disadvantaged communities. Per capita, the United States is the number one emitter of greenhouse gases. To avert climate chaos globally, Green for All believes that the United States must transition rapidly to a low-carbon economy with an emphasis on renewable energy and conservation measures. This transition could boost the U.S. economy, generating new opportunities for wealth and work, and new green pathways out of poverty will benefit 250,000 Americans directly. When all family members are included, the number of beneficiaries estimated are to grow beyond 1 million. Van, on behalf of all of us, and in recognition for your commitment, this award. Congratulations.
Photograph. And by the way, we have a $1 million challenge grant that's on the table. So if anybody wants to help us create green pathways out of poverty for poor kids in this country, please come up to me, talk to me. We need your help. Thank you.
It strikes me this is a really marvelous marriage of social goals. So good luck.
Thank you very much.
Pratt Industries. Let me invite Anthony Pratt, Chairman and CEO, to join me on the stage. This is a commitment to move the United States toward a zero-waste society by significantly expanding its recycling operations and creating a recycling movement to drive reform. It is valued at $1 billion. Inspired by Richard Branson's commitment to renewable energy, Pratt Industries is making a $1 billion commitment to move the United States to a zero-waste society. The commitment will significantly expand recycling operations and create a far-reaching recycling movement involving municipalities, sanitation departments, media companies, schools, and a wide range of suppliers of waste paper throughout the United States. Pratt will build at least 3 new recycled paper mills, 4 waste-to-energy plants, and 30 materials recovery facilities over the next decade. The construction of Pratt's 3rd recycled paper mill will commence later this year in Shreveport, Louisiana, and will be operational by December 2008. At full capacity, this mill will recycle over 300,000 tons of paper per annum and will facilitate the avoidance of more than 300,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. The construction of Pratt's 1st waste-to-energy plant will convert wood waste, otherwise destined for landfills, into energy in order to power the company's recycled paper mill in Georgia. And this plant will save over 75,000 tons of carbon dioxide per annum. This commitment will lead to the avoidance of millions of tons of CO2 each year and create hundreds of new jobs in the United States. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Let me give you a plaque here. Before you get a... Actually, it's yours.
Okay. No, I just like you.
What a big hug.
From Australia. No worries. Thanks a lot.
What's this? Yeah. Okay. I'm short here. All right. Let me invite Jeffrey Bortnicker, CEO of Equator Environmental, to the stage. This is a commitment of $100 million over 3 years.
Yes, correct.
Equator Environmental will create a $100 million private equity fund to invest in environmentally friendly and sustainable land, forest, or vegetation-based projects. It's an innovative, one-of-a-kind fund existing to enhance the viability of our environment, directly preserve ecological assets, and monetize such assets through the creation of eco-products. Through this commitment, Equator Environmental is advancing the belief that by establishing a fund to invest in projects that preserve and enhance the viability of our ecosystems, we can have a direct impact on the preservation of our ecological assets. Further, by monetizing assets through the creation of environmental credits and other eco-products, we can enhance the market value of our ecosystems and create further incentives for environmental conservation. Nice to see the financial community playing this role. Congratulations. Okay. Thank you. Good luck. The American Council on Renewable Energy, ACOR, is making commitment to advance a more robust policy and economic case for renewable energy solutions and amplifying influential voices to strengthen public understanding of climate change. I want to invite Michael Eckhart, President of ACOR, and Jessica Bailey, Program Officer, Sustainable Development Program for the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, to the stage.
Thank you. Jessica, you want to come?
Hi.
Hi.
It's already here.
Surrounded. So this is a commitment that will involve creating RECAP, the Renewable Energy Communications and Policy Program, a 3-year campaign that will put forward critical policy and economic analysis on energy supply, environment and climate, economic development and jobs, and national security. This unique work builds on ACOR's 2006 commitment to host a world meeting on renewable energy, which has now been successfully funded, and is scheduled to be held as the Washington International Renewable Energy Conference, WIREC 2008, on March 4th through 6th, 2008 in Washington. And with the funding it received, RECAP anticipates $5 million in subgrants to collaborative policy and communications partners that will help develop and disseminate ACOR economic and policy work. It will enable ACOR's 500 member organizations representing hundreds of thousands of renewable company employees and an estimated 3 million network partners to make a stronger case for climate solutions and economic opportunity in communities across the country. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I'm giving it to you, aren't I?
Here.
Yeah. How did you take hold of it?
Yeah.
Terrific. Congratulations.
You hang on.
Good
luck. Thank you very much.
Well, I've got a couple that that I'm going to recognize from the floor. As these commitments are just a few of many outstanding ones that have already come from CGI members this year. Barry Appleton and Jack Hittery are here from the Appleton Charitable Foundation and the Jack D. Hittery Foundation to not only announce a new commitment, but they've already, ahead of schedule, implemented their 2006 commitment. And just last week, they released a detailed National Sustainable Urban Transportation Study ranking Canadian cities for their transportation policy, something I understand has received a lot of publicity in Canada. And in 2007, they brought this analytical rigor and information to American cities. 2008, they will bring it, recognizing and encouraging further leadership by U.S. members. Could you stand up and let us all recognize you? Jonathan Rose, through the Rose Smart Growth Fund, will create a $25 million real estate investment trust that, he knows how much serious money is being announced up here. That enables more foundations and endowments to invest in green building projects by removing tax barriers that previously stood in their way. Jonathan Rose, you in the audience. Joshua Green, founder and managing director of the Verdeo Group, has offered to create a series of free workshops for senior U.S. business executives, especially CGI members, to help them assess the risks and opportunities of U.S. climate policy for their businesses. Joshua Green, we recognize you over here. Hey, congratulations. It was a tremendous amount of imagination and creativity that characterized these commitments, and it's very impressive to me that they're addressed to a whole range of social problems, making clear how we can address the climate problem in ways that benefit us economically in terms of social policy as well. So one more time, a hand for all of these commitments, and our very best wishes and good luck to you. Okay, Dan.
Thank you, Bill Riley, and thank all of you for your comments, your thoughts, your suggestions. Special thanks to those who have made commitments here today. It is inspiring to see the range of actions being taken to move us forward on this tough issue of climate change. But just when you think it may be dark and pessimistic, there is light at the end of the tunnel and lots of optimism in this room. I've been told that we're going to start again at 3:45, so we will break now for a few minutes. But please, before we go, join me in thanking our panelists for a very lively discussion.